I'm here with Elizabeth Nolan Brown, the editor of Blistree, and also a resident of the Bushwick neighborhood of Brooklyn, where I recently got to visit, and it's a fascinating place that you live, Elizabeth Nolan Brown.
Thank you.
I first went to Bushwick when I moved to New York in, I think, 2006, and we had a, I went around and looked at apartments for a day with the two roommates that I knew from college that, you know, we were moving into New York apartments and we were all starting graduate school of one sort or another, and we decided to live together. And we took the subway out to Bushwick and got off on a subway stop out there, and one of my roommates, who was with us, basically immediately said, I would not live here. No, there's no way that I'm possibly living here. And as we looked around, it was kind of like this, I've never been to Beirut, but when I read about areas of Beirut that were like bombed out and no one was living there anymore because all of the structures were compromised after kind of warlike periods, that was what I immediately went to in my mind, this uninformed idea of what Beirut was like. There were just, you know, warehouse buildings with broken windows and glass everywhere on the sidewalk, and it wasn't a scary neighborhood in the sense of looking around and being creeped out by the people around you or getting eyed by people who were hostile. It was just that there was like no one around. It was kind of deserted and there
kinda
were
looks like
weeds and
razor
wire. Yeah. Yeah. Just that, like, something terrible had happened and everyone cleared out, and you know, you were going to be walking down the street one day and Omar from The Wire was going to pop out, and like you and he would be the only ones, and he'd have a shotgun. I'm like, I don't know. That was what it felt like then, and it does not feel like that anymore. And why don't you tell me a little bit about your neighborhood, because you know better than me.
Well, my first experience with Bushwick was similar to yours. My ex-boyfriend had just moved here when I was living in Washington, D.C. And, his friend had just moved here, and we were staying at a hotel in the city in Manhattan. And he's like, meet me at the Jefferson stop in Bushwick on the L train. So we took it out here, and we got off. And it had been really nice in Manhattan, and then it had started raining in the interim. So we get off, and it's like this kind of sleet rain. It was December. And, it just looks like an industrial warehouse, like in a post-apocalyptic land, because there's just like nobody around, just huge warehouses still, which actually are a lot functional still. It looked like desolate and crazy, and we were just like, Bushwick is a terrible place.
For people unfamiliar with it, you were basically talking about an area of Brooklyn where you know, the L train runs from Manhattan basically kind of straight out over the river and into Brooklyn. And Bushwick is on the same train line as Williamsburg, where you read all the stories, the endless stories about Williamsburg hipsters and Hasidic Jews in Williamsburg who fight with Williamsburg hipsters. And this is farther out. It's like where young people used to move when they were right out of college and looking to live in the young 20-something neighborhood with, like, cheap enough rents that you could live right out of college. That neighborhood has moved out farther. And now you go, you know, some stops farther on the train, and this new neighborhood has become that. And Williamsburg is now
Williamsburg, and then you pass East Williamsburg, which, depending on who you talk to, is either, like, a historic thing or a total marketing real estate designation. And then you're in Bushwick, which, like, is people who say things like that things are the new Williamsburg say that Bushwick is the new Williamsburg. I guess I just said that, so I guess I am those people. But what I mean by that is that, like, a lot of people can't afford to live in Williamsburg anymore. I used to live in Greenpoint last time I lived here, and when I moved back, I couldn't afford to live in Greenpoint anymore either, so I then ended up moving into Bushwick, and pretty near the Jefferson stop, which is where I think you probably got off you were saying you got off, and that is where I got off back then, and it is totally different now.
Yeah, you come up now, and there are little bars and stores and restaurants, and it's a kind of development that is it's focused to a particular niche that I think is pretty interesting, because the coffee shops in your neighborhood are a pretty fascinating thing to me, because you can go in and get a really good cup of coffee. You can get cold brew iced coffee. You can get, you can talk to a barista who knows the origin of the beans and will describe the flavor profile of the couple of choices
that you have. I've never
done that.
I've never talked to a barista about that, for the record.
I've heard people talk to the baristas, and I don't really know when people talk about the flavor profile of coffee, I don't really know what they're talking about. You know what I mean? Like, I can hear them talking about it, but I can't connect it to, like, what I taste.
Yeah,
if you describe
yeah.
to me the flavor profile of three coffees, I don't really know which one is to my taste. But I do in fact really prefer what I would call good coffee. To, you know, going to 7-Eleven, say, and buying a cup of coffee. Like, I don't really like the drink if it's sort of bad coffee. But, like, a good cold brew iced coffee, I enjoy and I like. And so I do seek out these kinds of coffee shops and pay, you know, an extra 75 cents or a dollar for my iced coffee over what I would pay at, like, Starbucks or Dunkin' Donuts, say. And this is a kind of coffee shop that, where I've been subletting in Laguna Beach, California, you can't find that kind of coffee here. Even though it's a relatively wealthy neighborhood that isn't gentrified per se, because it was always a rich people neighborhood kind of, it's just not available. And so I'm interested that consumers in Bushwick, who are clearly living there, a lot of them because they can't afford rent elsewhere in New York City, but they are still there's still a market for this luxury good in Bushwick, and also a market for bars that are serving craft cocktails that cost $10, and for food that has menu items described with where the beef came from, and a hamburger that might cost like $13, say, and so this interests me. And I wonder, New York Magazine did a story a while back that was talking about how it's sort of unprecedented that this generation of youngish New Yorkers are spending more of their disposable income on food and foodie things, which all include coffee and craft cocktails and stuff. This is a thing they're spending their disposable income on, even when they don't have a lot of it and they're kind of like struggling to get by otherwise. Does this resonate with what you see in your neighborhood, and why do you think that is?
I don't know if I can speak to it in general. It resonates with me. I find that I spend the bulk of my disposable income, like, I don't buy a lot of entertainment or a lot of clothes or anything, but I mostly spend money on, like, food, coffee, alcohol, things like that. And I think that's definitely true. I mean, yeah, there are so many really great and reasonably priced, but I guess, more luxury good than comparatively around. So many coffee shops, so many little restaurants, vegan cafes, and, little convenience stores that sell tons of, like, kombucha and raw kale chips and ostrich jerky. But I also have, like, a significant number of friends around here who are on food stamps or who are, like, dumpster diving a lot for their food. So I think there's definitely a spectrum.
Yeah, well, and so do you think that it is it just that some people are living in Bushwick because it's cool to live there and they have parents who are helping to support them and so they can afford these kinds of things, and other people are trying to get by on their own and they're not patronizing these places and they're dumpster diving in their own food stamps? Or is it more
I think it's more complicated than that? Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely some of it. There's this really fancy building right next door to mine called that a lot of people live in that, I mean, it's like, I don't know, $2,000 or a month for a studio apartment or something. And so I don't know. We don't actually know, but everyone assumes that that's like these stereotypical trust fund kids. Mm-hmm. And a restaurant on the corner says they make up like 75% of the business. But I mean, then you also have people like me who I don't have a lot of money, but I don't pay a lot for rent. I live with a lot of roommates in like kind of a warehouse loft space, and I don't pay a lot of rent because I'd rather spend my money on other things. And so I think it just kind of also, there are people like that, and it depends on where you put your priorities and what you spend your money on, I guess.
And when you go to, when you go home to visit Ohio, or if you have friends from non-coastal parts of the country visit you, is there like a, is there a divide like between how much one expects to pay for, are they shocked at the idea of you paying, say, $10 for a cocktail? Do you adjust when you go home to Ohio and start to think of a drink as something that costs $4 or $5, and if one costs $7, you're like, wow, that's expensive. How does the sort of price adjustment in these very markets, I guess, work?
I mean, I don't really drink cocktails, so I don't really know about that. But I mean, I think the kind of place, you can still go to dive bars here and drink beer or, you know, like house wine relatively cheaply. I think the kind of place that you go and pay, like get fancy cocktails here, it's pretty much the same as the kind of places, like I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio, and I feel like prices there at those kind of places are actually really similar. I mean, I think it's different for Manhattan, but in Brooklyn, I feel like Brooklyn prices are comparable to Cincinnati, Ohio prices, at least.
And one other kind of pet peeve I have about Brooklyn, as it's talked about in the media, it seems to me that 75% of the stories I read about Brooklyn are about hipsters, and there is obviously a hipster presence in Brooklyn, as no one could escape knowing at this point. But the people that I interact with there and the friends that I have living there, you know, include some hipsters, but includes a lot of people who aren't hipsters, who are, and who are actually something that is, I think, pretty interesting and different, like people who don't identify with that ethos, and that also are really interested in a kind of small-scale entrepreneurialism and what's starting to be called the shared economy in the official vernacular. And I wonder what is getting missed by the insistence and the obsession with focusing on hipsters in these areas.
I mean, I think it just depends on how you define hipster, because I understand that hipster is like a useful shorthand for something. And so you get people who would call anyone who lives in like this area or in certain situations, like my loft space with 14 roommates, right, you just a hipster by virtue of like that. But you're right that like, I mean, like I have a roommate who just moved here from Milwaukee and wears like Dockers and dress shirts and works as a temp in an accounting office and like just all sorts of, I mean, that's not to say anything bad about him. He's really awesome and he's funny and has his quirks and he does comedy. So I guess there are like reasons that, I don't know, but it's not, no one I live with is like what you would define as a hipster. So
no one is the stereotype.
Yeah. Well, maybe if you are, but
oh, but there's 14 people. So.
Right. But, no, I mean, and I think that the bulk of the people that I know in Bushwick and in North Brooklyn would not meet the criteria for what people would describe as hipsters, like, if they met them elsewhere. I don't know.
Right, yeah. Well, you and I have just recently finished watching a show on our respective Netflix accounts, Arrested Development, where it had a 3-season run and was canceled when Fox decided it didn't want it anymore, but had a pretty substantial fan base, a cultish fan base, I would say. And Netflix decided to do a 4th season as an original series and got the cast back together. I guess this is 7 years later? Has it been that long?
Yeah.
And the new season was 15 episodes, and Fox released it. Netflix released it on the internet all at once and just kind of put it out there and said, all right, watch at your own speed. It's all there right now immediately. So how did you like watching TV in that way as opposed to every other series that you've ever had?
Well, sorry, the camera's rolling out. I tend to watch TV like that because I tend to just like watch series on Netflix that when they're not on. So mm-hmm. I guess this didn't feel that different in the way I was watching it, but it's different in the experience mm-hmm. because it's weird to do that and then have everybody talking about it. Like I kind of thought that maybe I was going to take longer to watch it, like spread it out a little while longer, except everybody on the internet was already talking about it. So I felt like to be a part of the conversation, I mean, and especially as a blogger, like I thought there might be things to write about in it. So I felt like I needed to watch it all pretty quickly.
Yeah. I really enjoy watching TV this way.
Yeah, I do too.
I've watched previous series like this before, and what I'll usually do is, like for example with The Wire, I wasn't really aware of it when it first started being broadcast, and a couple seasons in, lots of people started talking about how great it was, and I thought, okay, well, I'll give it a try. And so I went out and at that time rented the first series from my video store in Park Slope where I was living. And I watched the first season. I remember just like finishing the first disc and then like going to the video store and being annoyed that it wasn't open yet. And waiting around for like 15 minutes for it to open and getting the second disc and the third disc all in one. And I watched the whole first season and then got the whole second season. And I watched up to the point that was currently being aired, you know, within the space of a few days. And then I was just like, oh man, I have to wait now?
Yeah.
For these to come out like once a week, really? And then I have to wait between seasons? This is terrible. And I hated wait. I really hate waiting for it to come around once a week. Partly because it's obviously an instant gratification thing. You want to know what happens. You want to see what happens. But for me also, I don't spend a ton of time watching TV. And I don't like to schedule my life around it. And so it's really nice to not have this awkward hour in the middle of the day. Especially because I go to bed pretty late, so it really is the middle of my day. And so with a show, like Mad Men is the only show that I'm watching that's airing on TV right now, that I actually watch it when it airs usually. And, you know, sometimes I'll like forget or miss it and go and buy it on iTunes, but like I try and save myself the $1.99 by watching it when it airs. And I found that that takes a lot more time out of my life, not just because I'm watching the commercials, but because it's like, oh, Mad Men's coming on in 20 minutes. Not going to get anything done in these 20 minutes. And then, I wait around, and then, it's like I would have maybe I wish I could have gone and gotten dinner, but there wasn't enough time before it started, and then I still haven't eaten by the time it's over. Just all these logistical things that I'd much rather just have it all that I could watch any time. So completely apart from the quality of Arrested Development, I feel like I really hope things go in this direction where shows are just released a season at a time. But what I'm still undecided about is the creative implications for it and whether it changes the way that you make a show, whether it changes the way that people...
I think it definitely does change it. And I don't think I'd want to watch all TV like that. Like, I think that certain shows, it's not even like a certain type of show, but like certain shows it will make sense for, like this it made sense, but I don't think I'd want all television shows to be released like that at all.
Do you think that people are right that the newly released season wasn't as good as the original Arrested Development, or are you on board with it?
Let me go back to the like TV versus the internet thing, because I haven't had a TV just in years because I travel a lot and have lived in a lot of different places, and the only show I really watch religiously or have consistently is Mad Men. So for the past 3 years, I've just gotten a season pass on iTunes, and I get it delivered, you know, to my inbox sometime after Sunday night after it airs. And then I'm able to watch it. I used to work from home, and I would just watch it, like, whenever throughout the day. Now I go into an office, but I'll, like, often watch it in the mornings on Monday morning, like, as I'm getting ready for work so that maybe I can write about it mm-hmm. that day. And, yeah, that's, like, really convenient just to be able to do that. And you still, I mean, but it, that you still get all the convenience that way, and that's not being released all at once. Like, I appreciate the traditional structure of the release of the episodes still, even though, you know, I'm still watching them in a more convenient way, I guess.
Right.
But...
Right, yeah, so it'd be interesting to know, even though lots of us watch Mad Men all at once, if it was released all at once, if that would change the way that they filmed it. I don't necessarily know that it would, but maybe.
Yeah, I think it would depend on the show a lot. I mean, Arrested Development is a show that was particularly well suited just because of the structure of the show and the way everything is kind of interloops back on each other in the plot, and between the episodes, that I feel like it was particularly well suited to this. And that was something that they did when it aired on television also, but I feel like they did amp that up for various reasons, but
right.
One of them being that that they were releasing it in this manner.
Well, I guess one question is, do you think that, you know, if a show is being written as it's airing over many weeks, you know, there's the opportunity for the network to come in and give feedback, for the writers to be reading fan blogs and to kind of respond to people's complaints or wishes or whatever. And I guess part of one's opinion of the artistic merits of releasing it all at once or spacing it out is a question of if you think that writers being influenced that way is a good thing that is, you know, keeping them from going off in some direction that's just terrible without having any feedback, or if the feedback is a bad thing that's compromising their artistic vision. And I don't really have a strong opinion either way about that, but I bet TV writers would.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't know enough about how much feedback influences writers throughout seasons if they are writing it in a traditional way. But as I think it's interesting as far as the viewing experience goes, just, I mean, it feels like you were part of, I mean, everybody's kind of talking about it right now, but, like, does it become much more ephemeral this way? Is it going to continue to attract, like, new people now, or was this kind of, like, I don't know if it'll change the way that the show's, like, talked about or remembered also.
Yeah, it shortens the window in which people can decide, oh, maybe this is something that
it makes it, like, condenses the entirety of the season into one news cycle, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
A few news cycles.
Mm-hmm. And maybe that's especially difficult because we've trained ourselves to kind of, you know, when I'm trying to figure out whether to watch a show, I think, I don't really do this consciously, but I think that I've kind of trained myself to look for certain cues that is like, oh, this show keeps coming up in, like, different contexts over, like, a bunch of different weeks. Didn't I see this mentioned, like, 3 weeks ago in this piece, and then, oh, this other person is mentioning it now on Twitter? And so maybe I have to recalibrate my heuristics about which shows to watch if everything is just condensed down. But, you know, on the other hand, maybe people just discover shows long after the fact.
Yeah, and, like, I mean, yeah, it'll be on Netflix there for people to discover, just, like, you know,
So shifting gears, Blistery recently published a piece that was relatively controversial among bloggers that were talking about it, and it involved birth control. Why don't you introduce it since you are familiar with it?
One of our writers, Lisa Marie Basile, she wrote a piece about her own experience with birth control throughout her life. She's kind of an anomaly in this day and age, but she's never taken hormonal birth control at any point. So we thought that was interesting, and so she was going to write about that. And she also mentioned that, you know, she's in a committed relationship, and her boyfriend do not use condoms either, and they mostly just, like, rely on fertility awareness and the pull-out method, and that, you know, this is what she was doing. And she kind of thought maybe she wanted to be on birth control, but she had kind of an irrational fear of it. She even, you know, acknowledged she thought that her fear of, like, putting medicine in her body was a bit irrational, but that was how she felt. And it just got a lot of backlash from people, like, a large proportion of which was just nasty, which was just, like, you're stupid. But a lot of it was, like, you're stupid and you're making me embarrassed for women, or, you know, you're setting a bad example by representing women like this. You're just acting like what all conservatives think that women are like with birth control. Or also people got mad at her from a health standpoint. Like, you should be a role model because you're writing in this public forum and it is a women's health and wellness blog, although it's an opinionated one. It's not, a straight up news sort of thing. But, but they're saying that as such that she should have a duty to set a better example and, to not talk about things like this because younger girls or people who are less informed might get the idea that this was okay. And so the tenor of all of that commentary kind of surprised me a lot.
One thing she mentioned in her article is that she was averse to getting an abortion for various reasons, but that she would ultimately get an abortion if she became pregnant.
Yeah.
And I think that alone, I think, probably changed the reaction to the piece a lot because it automatically meant that there was going to be one cadre of people who thought, this terrible, irresponsible person's using abortion as birth control, and another group of people were going to say, oh no, you're giving the conservatives an example of a woman who just uses abortion as birth control. And I wonder if the reaction would have been as judgmental, had she not mentioned that. But so what surprised you about the tenor of the reaction? Because,
I
generally think of these as like really hot button topics that you kind of expect to be the kind of things that, that people on the internet react to.
I guess it was more that, in both the comments on the posts and on, her Facebook where she shared it, that actually got less vitriol than you would think. That bit, I felt like people, talked. It wasn't all focused on, the abortion aspect of it. There were just a lot of people who thought that by talking about having sex without condoms, even in a committed relationship, or, that saying that she uses the pull-out method and the fertility awareness method, which, by the way, are very, I've written about this a lot at Blistery, are statistically, when used effective as condoms. So it's not as stupid as everyone was saying anyways. But I just got surprised that people were telling her kind of just in general that she shouldn't talk about her experience with it because it wasn't necessarily a good one that we would want people to emulate. So therefore she shouldn't write it. And,
right. And I take it that your view is the opposite, that there's value in exploring how people actually live.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. And I think we see this in lots of realms on the internet with people, thinking that whatever community you represent or whatever, that you should kind of write as a perfect example of it. And that by sometimes admitting to flaws in your views on things or your strength and the norms that you're, kind of failing it. But I mean, I just think that, I don't know, I don't want a conception of writing that, it's just propaganda if you don't have people telling the truth. So I think obviously I disagree. But I think it was interesting something that Phoebe Motsbovy brought up in writing about it on her blog, What Would Phoebe Do?, about whether or not things like this, exploring the complexities and human flaws, were better left to fiction as opposed to this sort of confessional writing. And I thought that was an interesting question.
Yeah, well, she's attracted to fiction partly because, she occasionally writes about parental overshare, where a parent will, write about some problem they're having with their teenage kid, say, and they'll write about it in the New York Times or in, a very prominent publication. And her argument is basically that these parents who do this are violating the privacy of their children, and that this is going to be an indelible thing that they put out there about their kids on the internet forever, and with, various implications for their lives going forward, depending on depending on the nature of the subject they're talking about. And she, especially when there are privacy issues like that about writing about other people, she argues basically, what's wrong with fiction? Can't we, there is value in exploring these situations. There is value in exploring these situations and learning more about how other people really live, but why can't we do these in fiction? You know, I guess one answer is that people are reading nonfiction now more than fiction. And
that's what I was going to say.
but why is that? Well, you know, and there have been these controversies about the memoir writers who, there's one that went on Oprah and then it was discovered that he was lying. And, you know, there have been all kinds of mini memoir scandals. Did this really happen or was this shaded in a way that, exaggerated it? Is this memoir writer cheating? There's a Hemingway's book about living in Paris when he was young, A Movable Feast, has an introduction that says something to the effect of maybe it's better that you take this as fiction. I'm writing about my life, I'm writing about what happened, but maybe it's better if you think of it as fiction. I'm forgetting exactly what it was, but he kind of nodded toward this idea that maybe it's best if we don't draw a distinct line. And I think that there have also been controversies about that book, Travels with Charlie, where John Steinbeck drove around America. And people have gone and reconstructed it and talked about how, well, this thing couldn't really have happened. And it's hard for me to read Travels with Charlie and not think it's wonderful and want whatever it is, whatever you want to call it.
And then I read it.
To want that thing. It's just, it's amazing travel. It's just like a classically American travel book. But yeah, I wonder if there is some in between fiction and fact, and you know, explicitly so, like, not trying to put one over on the reader or anything. But I wonder if there would be value in a kind of in between genre, where people could try their best to get at the truth in the way that the best fiction does, without tying themselves to what happened in the way that, you know, that I tie myself to it if I write about something in The Atlantic or if I, you know, write in the realm of explicitly creative nonfiction.
I feel like, I mean, the genre exists and has always existed, but people just call it fiction because, especially more so now because everyone's so, you know, concerned about liability. So I feel like if there's any, I feel like a lot of fiction, I mean, we know that a lot of fiction is based on real stuff and people just sort of fictionalize it. And I think for novels, And novellas and that kind of thing, it makes sense. With shorter pieces, I mean, there's not a huge short story market, and confessional essays, I think, in terms of, like, journalism, sell really well, and it's so much easier for people to publish confessional essays than a lot of other types of writing. So I think part of it is just people get pushed into doing that a lot.
Yeah, I wonder, I mean, we just think of a short story as this thing. I guess I should say we think of short fiction as being a short story. We think of it as being like a New Yorker story, I think. And I don't know, I wonder...
You know, I've got to tell you.
Yeah, go ahead.
The first and only short story that I've ever had published in some little literary magazine is a story that is fiction, but it's totally, I took characters that I knew in a situation that could have happened and then, you know, wrote it as if that situation happened. And, right. But I mean, of course that's fiction, but that's, I feel like kind of one of the, I feel like that kind of thing is a little bit of the a little bit like the hybrid you're talking about.
Right. Well, and there are definitely some essayists who take on more of a personality in their own essays than other people, you know, who as they write what is basically nonfiction, they're also adopting a persona as narrator that is kind of like more or less, depending on who they are, distinct from the actual person. And, you know, I think that my narrator's voice in my nonfiction is like pretty close to me.
Yeah.
I think that it's never completely the same as talking to someone in person, but I'm not trying to like have a character that is different. But it would be fun to write nonfiction from a wildly different character's perspective, I think. And I guess it just seems so much muddier then we treated in these like very different boxes.
Yeah.
And it seems like there would be more experimentation in the in-between spots. And I don't see a lot of experimentation in the in-between spots, though. Even at places, and maybe I'm just like missing tons of great posts that people will point out. I hope that's true when we have this conversation. But like, you know, thinking about reading the more experimental places, I don't like go to the All one day and see something that's like really blending the lines of these genres in a way where I think, oh, that's an interesting way to do this. I've never thought of doing it that way before. And I wonder, like, if I would talk to Will Wilkinson, who's doing that creative writing program down in Houston, I think, if he would know people in that world who were kind of blending these
but
areas
not,
in a way that was interesting.
I'm not sure I understand how you would be blending... How you would be blending them aside? If like if you were adopting a wildly different voice than your own, would you still be telling true stories in that voice? Like I don't understand how you're thinking of blending them beyond the traditional ways.
What I mean is, so there's one issue, right? Of like, what do you disclose to the reader?
Right.
And I think that I fit within the kind of journalistic norm in thinking that it is important to disclose to the reader, you know, we have the norms of nonfiction, and if you're going to depart from those in some way, it's important to be upfront about that. And whether that means saying, oh, I have, you know, I've made a composite character in this narrative of all the people that I met when I was in this country travel.
Right.
Or, you know, whatever. And so, like, Barack Obama did that and disclosed it in one of his biographies. And people have, in one of his autobiographies, and people have argued about whether he did it in a way that was fair or unfair, but, like, whatever, he disclosed it, and so he blended genres in that way, right?
Right. And we are, but we allow that to exist. Like, that's a convention, I guess, already, right?
Yeah, I mean, it does happen, and like I said, you know, Hemingway kind of disclosed it when he wrote that book, and certainly, Steinbeck could have disclosed it, but didn't. But, yeah, I mean, composite characters are just, like, one of all sorts of different ways that you could blend the areas. And you know, like, so if you think about how, if you think about the rise of kind of creative nonfiction going back to people like Gay Talese, who decided that they were going to use the techniques of fiction to tell these nonfiction stories, and they were going to do these like really deeply reported things so that they could try and get inside the mind of the characters, and they were going to tell it from all different angles in a narrative that was, you know, that was like driven forward in the way that a story would be. Well, so one thing that I've talked about with a few of my writer friends is like, it would totally be possible to kind of do the opposite thing now, and to write a fictional story in the way, you know, that reads as if it is a long New Yorker story or a long Harper story, right?
Right.
And that this would be another way to tell a story, another way to get at the truth of something, to write fiction in this style that borrows the techniques of long-form nonfiction journalism and that, like, borrows the trappings of it and the style of it. Because it's a style that people are used to hearing stories in, just as Gay Talese was drawing on a style that was, like, the storytelling that was familiar to the people who were reading in his day, who were a lot more accustomed to reading fiction. And... I think that we've been going into different boxes, even like, you know, The Atlantic is a magazine that used to publish a lot more fiction than it does now, right?
Right.
A lot of magazines have kind of stripped out the fiction section, and we do a fiction issue now, but like it's kind of a part. I don't know, it seems like in this era of all of this different experimentation in storytelling, it's kind of all happening within the nonfiction genre. And I wonder...
Yeah.
If I kind of hope the lines blur in some interesting way that I'm probably not articulating very well because it would be experimental and I don't know exactly what it would look like.
And maybe it's happening and we're just not friends with a lot of fiction. I'm not friends with a lot of fiction writers. But I agree. I don't like most of the short stories I read in most traditional venues. So I'd be excited about new conceptions of blurring the lens between fiction and nonfiction.
So let's talk about Meat and Mark Bittman's article on Meat in the New York Times.
Mark Bittman wrote a piece in the New York Times about meat, which is what we just said. And but his whole thing is that you can buy better meat if you buy less meat, which I think is true. Better quality meat, more humanely raised meat or whatever, if you eat less meat. And what some of the ideas he gives are like still using meat in your recipes, but just calling for recipes that rely a lot more on vegetables and make meat just part of it instead of the main dish. And I think that's all very fine and a good idea, good ideas. But he talks about, you know, he starts off by saying that he's eating less meat and he thinks his new habits conform to the attitudes of, he says, the vast majority of Americans are changing their attitudes about meat and they're eating less of it, or they're thinking more about how they're eating it and thinking more consciously about it. And I don't necessarily think that that's true. I feel like it's, I mean, like maybe in a lot of the circles that he is in, but I feel like amongst a lot of people I know in places that's not true at all.
Well, I don't know. I mean, this is a tough one because it's we all have our different circles in which we
buy,
and I suppose. It seems like at the very least there are the idea that that dishes without meat should be delicious is spreading.
Yeah.
Maybe not as quickly as vegetarians and vegans would like, but it's. The proverbial steamed vegetable plate is no longer the only offering at a lot of restaurants. And I think that probably the average wedding, say, has a more delicious vegetarian option than it would have 20 years ago, maybe. And I guess I would also say that while people's expectations about how often they eat meat might be different, in my world of dining, it is not the case that a meal that didn't have meat included as one part of it would be thought of as like as failing to offer your guests a nice meal.
Yeah, I mean, like in my family in suburban Cincinnati, like that I think still kind of is the case.
Yeah.
But I guess more like you were saying, like, I think people are coming around to the idea more that you can have delicious food that, yeah, does not involve meat. I think the whole, like, Meatless Monday movement, I think it's a really good idea that, you know, that there's a lot of framing it less as people should go vegan or vegetarian, and it's more like, hey, just try to eat less meat, like, try to cook more vegetarian. And I think that's great. Mm-hmm. I guess maybe my problem with, another one of my problems with the Mark Pittman article was that, you know, he talks a lot about how If you eat less meat, you can focus on all these things, like if it's locally sourced and humanely raised and grass-fed and all of that. And I just still feel like we're not at a point, like, I feel like we should be encouraging people to eat less meat. And when you focus on all of that so much, it just kind of distracts from the issue of trying to get people to just eat less meat and eat more vegetables and all the, like, labels about all the different kinds of meat and how to buy the best kind. I mean, there's definitely an audience for that, but I feel like this conception that we should be pushing that to everybody, like, I don't think that's a good, I don't know, I don't think that's a good,
you know, when I read
message.
When I read his piece, I was thinking, you know, part of his argument was basically, it was basically that he still eats meat, but will just eat a smaller portion than he once did. And, you know, again, as you said, he says that this is a widespread thing. And I don't doubt that, like, lots of people in lots of different places are having this change
right,
in their
right,
relationship
definitely.
To meat and how
definitely.
It's sourced and, like, you know. But I think what Bittman leaves out by writing an article that's only focused on meat is that there are all these countervailing trends where it's like everything is at some point everything is attacked, right? At some point meat is attacked for like its environmental consequences and its health consequences and whatever. But then like grains are also attacked, right?
Right, then you have the paleo diet, the unexplainable popularity of the paleo diet.
and you know, the Atkins diet before that, and I just feel like there are all sorts of, I think that we've become more conscious of our food generally, and that's led in some cases to healthier eating, but it's also led in other cases to just kind of weird food trends. Like, one thing that we're not talking about at length today, but that we had discussed is acai berries. And there's an interesting article in the New Yorker recently about the kind of rise of acai berries and these two guys who went down to Brazil and discovered people eating acai berries and decided they were going to import them and introduce this to American markets. And this whole kind of health craze that followed about the antioxidant qualities of acai berries and like these really great to... And, you know, coconut water is another thing that is huge in California.
Yeah.
People talking about coconut water, it's so healthy for you, it replenishes your system, blah, blah, blah. I just feel like there's a lot, like, everything is a lot more food-driven than it once was. There are a lot more food trends, diet trends, and so some of those are anti-meat, but some of those are pro-meat. And, you know, there's even, like, what one could plausibly call a bacon movement, right? It seems like everywhere I go now, there are bacon on things that I never would have expected to see before. I went to a taco joint the other day, and I ordered, like, a chicken taco.
I thought you said a disco joint. A taco joint. Got it.
No, a taco joint. And I ordered, like, three tacos, all of them with a different meat, and they asked, with all of them, if I wanted bacon on the tacos. And... That seemed crazy to me. Yesterday I was at a place that had bacon-wrapped pork belly. I don't know. I think that...
So it's not just my family in Ohio. It's also foodies on the East and West Coast and everywhere. Yeah, I mean, like, I just don't think the vast majority of anyone anywhere are really eating less meat.
Well, and I think that I do think in some ways people are eating less meat, but I also think the idea that, so Bittman brings up veal, right, and talks about how fewer people eat veal because of ethical concerns, and the same thing, you could say that about foie gras, you could say it about, like, lots of different things, right, but I think part of the point is that, like, Americans aren't just eating steak and beef anymore. We're eating all kinds. We're eating a much wider variety of meats. And the fact that we're eating a much wider variety of meats and a wider variety of cuts and a wider variety of ethnic cuisine, in a way, that makes us more educated about food. But in another way, it makes it impossible to know where everything is coming from because there's only so many things, the sourcing of which you can look into.
Right, I mean, like, pushing that as the standard just is... unsustainable, really.
Well, so it just seems like, you know, maybe we're just not at a point right now where we have the infrastructure, the labeling, the consciousness to do this on a large scale, and maybe we will one day.
But
you know, I think about this a lot with fish, because I've been writing about one of the founders of SeaWorld, who went on to be an ocean conservationist, and I've been thinking a lot about different fish in the ocean and which fish we shouldn't be eating because of the way that it's caught or because of the depletion of species. You know, you read articles about, like, bluefin tuna disappearing, and it's just very difficult to know, you know, if you go and order a fish taco someplace. Half the time you don't know what kind of fish it is, and half the time they tell you what kind of fish it is not, in fact, that kind of fish. And it isn't necessarily the restaurant that's lying to you either. They could have bought it at a, you know, they could have bought it from a source who is representing it as one thing when it's actually another.
And I think that was the problem with acai berries. It said that, I mean, that a lot of people just, once they became, like, the superfood and got all hyped, there was just a lot of really crappy acai berries. And the acai berry products on the market that weren't actually, like, made with writer potent enough to have health benefits.
Well, it's partly that our attitudes about food are so much, we all want deeply to believe that we can find a new delicious thing that has wonderful health properties, and that if only we spend the extra $2 at the grocery store to get this thing that we actually like eating, that we should, if we just start eating like a lot of this thing and changing our diet, and like health and longevity will be as easy as that. Wouldn't it be wonderful if acai berries actually were as wonderful as its biggest boosters made it out to be, right?
Right.
That would be wonderful. And I think it taps into like something in us that, like, oh, this thing that they found in the rainforest that traditional peoples have
right,
been
it's got a good story.
Years,
it's
just,
like maca powder
and,
or maca root.
It recurs too many times for it to be a coincidence, and I'm not sure I understand exactly what it is about us that makes us fall for these stories, but they're compelling in some way that makes people go out and start buying acai berries in large quantities. And I should say that I really like acai berries, and I put them in smoothies, and they are a good substitute for other fruits for me because they taste less sweet.
Yeah.
My palate has changed, and I don't like things that are too sweet tasting. And so, but I am always curious when I see the trend that I've seen most recently around where I live. You know, going back to when I was like in junior high school or something, a lot of frozen yogurt shops started to open around Southern California, and you know, I think there was frozen yogurt before that, but this was like a few chains that I'm thinking of were just like everywhere, and people would go out for frozen yogurt all the time, and like frozen yogurt was everywhere. And now a bunch of frozen yogurt places have closed just within the last like 5 years, say, and a lot of them have been replaced, like in the same spots in strip malls and retail outlets. They've been replaced by juice and like juicing. So, you know, now instead of going to get frozen yogurt, some of the same people are going to get, you know, freshly juiced, a mix of kale and cucumbers and lemon and ginger, say. What is it that made that trend happen? I don't entirely understand it, because we're talking about really like a large, like there must be a lot less frozen yogurt being eaten. And there's certainly a lot more juice being sold at like really expensive prices.
I think you're conflating two different trends though. Cause I think with like the acai berry thing, you get this all the time, these kind of magic bullet things. And I mean, one of the reasons they tend to fail is because with any diet, I think there's so much that people need to cut out. It's more about things that they need to cut out rather than one or two things they can add. But I also think this is like a big problem I have with health reporting and nutrition and food reporting in general, is that everything is reported as like, blueberries do this, acai berries do this, you know, like there's this new thing and it's going to be the superfood that solves all your problems. And then when people find out that there's been a little bit of conflicting evidence or that there's some new one, people just get really confused, and then it's just like, why should I listen to any of this stuff? And so I think that's why, because things just kind of get reported like that, and because people like the idea of the magic bullet approach. With the yogurt shops and the juice bars, because like juicing was a big trend, I don't know, in the 80s or something, right? There was the first initial wave of juice bars, and I feel like now it's a different kind of juice bar. But I feel like things like that and the frozen yogurt shops, which, like, all those kind of frozen yogurt shops are all now replaced by the, like, pink berry and red mango and the kind where you pick all your own ingredients. Like, those are everywhere now. So I think that all of those things are just sort of cyclical and marketing driven. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, well, and that's, to me, the most confounding one was the rise and somewhat fall of cupcake shops. Because
good riddance!
Because no one ever thought that was a healthy trend, right?
Like, right.
I think, like, even frozen yogurt, people thought of it as, like, oh, this is healthier than ice cream. It's a dessert that, like, is relatively low calorie. It's a treat that is, like, not so bad.
Right.
And you know, juicing, like, people, like, whether you guys healthy. But yeah, cupcake shops were, like, this is just, like, you know, people like cupcakes, okay. But such a sudden rise in popularity, I don't know. But you're glad to see the cupcake shop.
I am. I think my explanation for all of it is the media. I'm like, meh, media. Like, I feel like the cupcake trend was largely media-driven, too. And then once it reaches a tipping point or something, then, you know, everyone just, like, thinks, like, oh, I've got to go try these cupcakes. And they don't really know why. They just do, you know.
I would like you to write an angry screed against the pro-cupcake bias in the mainstream media.
I will. I've been championing the death of the cupcake trend for years. I'm very pro macaron though, so.
So let's talk about one last thing. I wrote a post a couple of days ago about a music student at Northwestern University, and he's a grad student. He has a final coming up. I think it's still coming up. And for this final, the members of his class are supposed to perform three works together. I think it's part of a choir. They're all, like, singing together. And one of the songs has lyrics written by the poet Walt Whitman. And this young man has decided that he will not sing the song because he says that Walt Whitman was a racist. Walt Whitman certainly was a racist, like so many Americans of his era, and, you know, said some terrible things, has a pretty complicated relationship with race, actually. He was kind of a racist abolitionist. He was on the side of abolishing slavery, but also certainly did not think that that blacks were equal or should be treated as equal, and he worried about what would happen after abolition in various ways and said some terrible things, and blah, blah, blah. So this song in particular, though, has nothing that the student regards as offensive within the song. It's just that this guy, who he studied in other contexts, Walt Whitman, he feels because of the racism that he exhibited, he doesn't want to sing a song that has words written by Walt Whitman. And his professor basically said, well, okay, I'm going to have to fail you if you will not do one-third of the final. And so that is the controversy, and the student, as best I can tell, went to the media, and this is why it's being discussed. I've seen it on a bunch of different blogs.
Yeah.
Punches a lot of cultural hot buttons, that is getting discussed, predictably, I would say. It's predictable that the story would spread. You know my take, having read it before. I lay it out. What do you think about this? Should he be failed if he doesn't do this? Is he taking the right attitude toward this? Is it right that he, you know, what do you think?
I mean, within this small context, I guess I don't really understand why the professor just wouldn't let him sing another song or, you know, like, yeah, do something else. I don't understand why, like, this particular Walt Whitman song and singing it is so crucial. Mm-hmm. But that being said, I think, yeah, I don't necessarily agree with the student's reasoning at all. And I read your post, and, yeah, I agreed with, you know, your general idea that we went around judging all works of art and various thoughts in history by all of the personal opinions of, you know, their creators, then they wouldn't leave us with a lot left.
Yeah, not only would we have a lot less good things, but we would only be hurting ourselves, I guess,
right,
is another part of it. Like, in no way will this stigmatize Walt Whitman in a way that will change his behavior because he's dead. And
right.
It seems obvious, but...
Yeah, I mean, it's...
But, like...
Just more the... Yeah, I think it's bad in general to judge, you know, works of art solely... It's interesting to discuss. It can be one facet of, like, looking at it. But, yeah, I don't think you should just reject it. I mean, one of my favorite authors is Fitzgerald, and he has, like, all sorts of crazy misogynist views wrapped up in all sorts of interesting, awesome views wrapped up in a lot of good works of art. And I just think that, like, just, yeah, highlighting one of those things and picking that out as something that, like, overrides all the rest is a really weird way to look at it.
And, yeah, and I think it seems more actually defensible to do that in an individual case until you start thinking about what it would mean if you really adopted that norm.
Right.
Because we'd start spending a lot of time researching the personal opinions of people who created some work of art or some idea or some mechanism for doing, you know, some invention, whatever. And I really think that we don't have the maturity as a culture to adjudicate these sorts of questions. I think it would become a basically, it would quickly become a, well, this person was racist. Well, this person was sexist. Well, this
right,
person
and everybody,
was
like,
this person,
everybody in history
like,
is going to have homophobic opinions. There are a large majority of people, you know, during certain time periods.
And so do we really want to put ourselves in the situation of having to adjudicate whether, like, well, this poet hated women, but this one hated gays.
And which
like,
is worse, and, yeah.
Right. So I do think, though, and one thing I didn't talk about in the piece that I think is kind of a tangent, but an interesting one, I think it gets trickier if you talk about someone who is working today, right? Like a living artist or a living person.
Yeah.
Because unlike Walt Whitman, there is value in changing people's behavior and the stigma we have today about, say, racism, right?
Right.
And so I can argue both sides of it really easily, right? On one hand, if there was a racist heart surgeon who developed some stent that saved a bunch of people, should we use that invention, even though this racist guy is getting the royalties? I say absolutely.
Right.
Like,
of course.
You don't want to let a heart patient die, and I think everyone would be like, of course. On the other hand, if there's this, like, violently racist writer who writes...
Or recording artist, right?
Who writes a really nice pop song or a really nice essay on strawberries. Should the New York Times publish that essay on strawberries of this guy who's mostly known for his, like, racist writing? Because that piece on strawberries is separate, right? But I think the New York Times wouldn't publish that guy on strawberries. And I don't know. I don't have really clear enough thoughts about that. This essay, but whether the New York Times would publish it, the stigma of how racists, violent racists should be treated, I'm not ready to, like, come down in any definitive way, but partly because of the complication of, like, the heart thing that I said. I definitely think we should use that heart.
Yeah. But
I think a lot of people would think we shouldn't publish that thing in the New York Times, and that it's good that people who are racist are stigmatized and kind of put outside of that we think that's bad enough and damaging enough to society that people who hold that view are not participants in polite society, are not participants in not part of our community, I guess. So I don't know, it's a tricky thing.
Well, like you said, I think, like, when you're talking about people in right now, but yeah, it's good to have a norm that we don't do that. That, like, we don't let people who have these radically racist or sexist or whatever views, you know, just, yeah. But I think that obviously it comes down to an individual basis. Like, if the particular thing that they're contributing outweighed, and that could be a work of art or a medical thing. Like, it'd be obviously harder to make the case for a work of art, but, like, yeah, I think it comes down to, I think it's just something that, the norm should be against it, but it comes down to a case-by-case basis, I guess. But all of this is just making me think of Chris Brown and kind of, I mean, that's kind of a different thing, but he's the one sort of...
As a debate dramatized on an episode of Glee. It's very heated. Pretty well handled, I would say. I guess we will leave this blogging head to pondering Chris Brown and maybe either listen to his songs or not listen to his songs per our conclusions as we go about the rest
of
our
eating days. Bacon or not eating bacon.
Yes, I will be eating bacon.
I will not.
there you go. Another divide. Well, it has been fun, and I hope we do it again sometime.
Yes, thanks for having me on, Connor. Bye.
All right.